You know how it makes you sweat? Most times chilly, I just start sweating, you know, in the head. And this is awesome. Well, let's open your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 4. We've got a lot of ground to cover. 1 Timothy chapter 4. And we're going to be starting, I think, in verse 11 this morning, or verse 12. Now, keep in mind, Paul is writing to his young protege, Timothy. Why? Because he's a young pastor. And he's telling him how the church ought to function that he's pastoring at. And really, the core verse of all of this is chapter 3, verse 15, when it says, "These things I'm writing to you, Timothy, that you might know how the church is to function, which is the pillar and the ground of truth." In other words, he says, this is it. This is so important. It's the pillar. It's the mainstay. It's the main thing, guys. It's keeping the main thing the main thing. And the ground of truth, the foundation, if you would. And he says, "I'm writing these things that you might know how the church is to function, to be that foundation, to be that root, to be that thing that we go back to." And so in chapter 1, he talks about the church and its message. The message is to be simple, it's to be focused, it's to be about the person of Jesus Christ, staying away from controversies and genealogies which do not edify. In chapters 2 and 3, Paul talks about the church and its members, that the members of the church are to be praying men, submitted women, and qualified leaders. And that brings us to the third area of discussion, which is where we're at currently, and that is in chapter 4, where Paul talks about the church and its minister. And then in chapter 5, that's the church and its ministry to itself. And then finally in chapter 6, it's the church and its ministry to the world. Now, last time in chapter 4, verses 1 through 11, there's two things that Paul first of all exhorted Timothy to do. Number one, he says in verses 1 through 6, be a good minister, Timothy. How do you do that? You remind folks of the simple truths. Verse 6 is the key to that section, guys. He says, put the brothers and put the sisters in remembrance of these truths. It's not going to be easy because the times are going to get treacherous. In fact, Paul says that the Spirit speaks expressly, clearly, that in the last times people will be seduced by spirits and they will depart from the faith. He also instructed them, along with being a good minister, to be a godly minister in verses 7 through 11. How do you do that? Exercising, you remember? You're to be a godly minister, exercising yourself in godliness, in spiritual disciplines, if you would. And the result may perhaps and well be suffering, persecution. People are going to take shots at you. They're going to be mad. They're going to be angry at you. But it only verifies that, Timothy, you're one of us. And so now Paul goes on to say in verses 12 through 16, how to be a growing minister. Now, listen, guys. We're not just talking about pastors. We're not talking about full-time ministers. We established this, you know, a few weeks ago, and that is that you all are ministers. You all are servants. So these principles, these precepts, these characteristics, they do apply to you. And then we need to ask the Lord to help apply these things to our lives. So what things is he saying? Well, here again, how to be, if you would, a growing minister. And he says there in verse 12, let no one, first of all, despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, or lifestyle, in love, in spirit or zeal, in faith, and in purity. Guy just came right out of seminary, thought he was all that. He was requested to fill the pulpit for a local church, and he arrived, and he was just all over it, and he just had it all together. Had his notes all outlined, and everything was perfect. He was ready to go. He thought, this is going to be easy. And so he arrived, and after being introduced, all sure of himself and all sure of the message that he had prepared, he walked up there, got behind the pulpit, and he froze. He didn't have a word. He couldn't say a word. He couldn't even move. He looked at all the people, and he just freaked out. And he ran out. And as he ran out, he tripped as he was coming down and did a huge face plant right in the carpet. And as he picked himself up and ran out, the elderly lady in the front seat said, if he would have come up the way that he came down, he would have been okay. I say that because it's hard to serve the Lord to any degree when you're young. Because, see, you have a tendency to look, you know, have not so much you, but people have a tendency to look down on you. Who do you think you are? You know, you're just a little whippersnapper. You're just a little high schooler or a college freshman. You're just 25 years old. I remember when I first started in ministry. It was a long time ago. It was when I was actually in high school. It was when I taught my very first Bible study. And I know that there were people, and I remember going on full-time staff with Raul. There were people that are saying, well, what are you hiring that guy for? He's a goofball. You know, nothing good's going to come out of this thing. But you look at this and you say, well, teenager, you know, 20-year-old, 30-year-old, does it capture the meaning of let no man despise thy youth? Paul deals with this tendency when he tells Timothy, let no man, Timothy, despise your youth. Now, if you look at the Greek language there, the word youth translates to neotis. You might recognize the word neo or new. It was a term that was used for any person or men that were really of the age of military service back in the Roman days in the Roman Empire. But in Paul's day, a man was eligible for the draft up and through the age of 40, guys. And so the word here, youth, neotis, could refer to anyone up and through, really, the age of 40. And so he's not just talking about a 13-year-old, a 17-year-old, or a 20-year-old even. Linguistically, it can mean up and through the age of 40. So does that mean that when Paul was writing this to Timothy, that Timothy is 40 years old? I'd say probably not. But as we look at it at this point, when Paul, according to when he wrote to Philemon, the book of Philemon, we find that there he was, even Paul was, up in ages. Because he was referred to as the aged one. What does that mean? I don't know, but I think Paul was pretty old at that point. And Paul the aged would look at Timothy and say, you know what, Timothy, you're still a young man. Even if Timothy was 40 years old, hey, you're still, it's all relative, right? I can remember when 30 seemed to me to be ancient. But now that I'm 32, I look at those that are 30 and I think, man, those are just puppies, you know, they're kids. And Paul says, don't let any man despise your youth. It could very well be that he's 40, but that's not likely. Most likely, Timothy's in his late teens or early 20s at this point. And I don't have time to go into the reasons why we believe that, but suffice it to say, Paul looked at him as a young man, which created certain tensions because at that time, there were certain writings that were circulating through the early church that would indicate that even if Timothy had been 40 years of age, it would have been problematic for many. Not too many years after Paul had written this letter, there were writings known as the apostolic canons that began to circulate throughout the early church. And in those canons, if you would, it declared that a man should not be appointed to be a pastor until he was past the age of 50, at which time he would be beyond youthful disorders. Now, I don't know what youthful disorders necessarily are. I know I had quite a few disorders, I'm sure, and you guys did as well too. But this writing was out there, and it was going around. And the early church, and they were saying, you shouldn't even think about being a pastor until you're 50 because you're still vulnerable to youthful indiscretions. Once you have passed 50, then you have some maturity. And I kind of have to wonder if anybody asked these guys, what about Jesus? I mean, he started public ministry when he was 30 years old. So is he not qualified? But this group would say, hey, anybody under 50 or under 40 certainly would be unqualified to be a pastor and to be a leader. And so Paul the aged, again, comes back and says, Timothy, don't let anybody put this trip on you. Let no man despise your youth. Now, I'm spending some time on this, and it's important, guys, and these qualities as well. And one of the reasons is that I urge you that, and I'm looking around, but those that are younger here, guys, do not let anybody despise your youth. Don't let people, in other words, come to you and say, you know what, you can't be used in ministry. You know, you're just too young. You're only 30, or you're only 35, or you're only 25. Guys, That's the time to get going. That's the time for you to get engaged. I've noticed something about people when they get older, and that is that they no longer have the courage to step out. They no longer have the oomph to grab a hold of opportunities because they think that their lives are way too complicated. They no longer have that ability to say, hey, let's just go for it and see what happens. Hey, you know, let's just holler up there and say, hey, and if they tell us to come up there, hey, Jonathan, if they tell us to come up there, hey, we'll go up there and we'll know the Lord is with us. If they say, wait down there, then we'll book and get out of here because we know the Lord isn't in it. But he had that, let's go for it. No, when you grow older, it's, oh, I have to take care of this, and I have to do that, and I have to take, and the years begin to slip by, and so many people I've seen miss out on so many opportunities to serve the Lord. Guys, if the Lord has come upon you and placed a calling within you, I encourage you to begin serving and ministering regardless of what old fuddy-duddies say. Oh, you don't know enough yet. And I know that there's balance, guys. There's balance in that he says, don't lay hands on any man swiftly or quickly. You know, there is some things to be said for maturity, but to hold the person back. And so Paul, you know, here talking to Timothy, here's what you do. And he says, here's the solution to it. And that's why he combines these two thoughts in this one verse. Don't let anybody look down on your youth. Oh, and here, by the way, you be an example. Here's how you counter that. Here's how you silence your critics. Here's how you take care of those that would say you have no business doing what you're doing. Because there will be those, Timothy, that will say you are just too young. Timothy, don't argue with them. Don't get into these arguments. There's, you know, again, what I want you to do simply is to be an example to them of the believer. In other words, silence them by your conduct. Just live your life in such a way that they will see there's something deep, that there's something rich, that there's something unique about you. As the Lord has come upon you, as the Lord has put a calling upon your life, and he's using you in this way. Allow the Lord to work in that way. And so then Paul goes on at this point, after he says, don't let anybody look down and despise your youth, and be an example, and he begins to enumerate very clearly what those things are to be. And he presents for Timothy six characteristics that would silence those who sought to criticize Timothy and say that he wasn't old enough or that he wasn't ready. And Paul says, let these things be in you. What things? Number one, you are to be an example in word, or if you would, in speech. You are to be an example in your conduct or your lifestyle, in your love, in your zeal, in your faith, and in your purity. Six things that will silence those that criticize you and tell you that you are too young. Timothy, be an example. Now, here's the deal with that. If Timothy was to be an example of the believers, if he was to be an example, because he was pastoring a member of the church in Ephesus, if he was to be an example to those that he was pastoring in Ephesus, then who was to be an example for Timothy? If Timothy was to be an example, who's going to be the example for him? Now you say, Paul, but Paul, and Paul was a mentor, more of a mentor, but an example in these things, Paul was the aged, Paul was an old dude. A lot of the leadership was old at that point as well. And that's not to say, like I said, that there's not a lot of wisdom there, guys, and value in that. But who is the example for him? And who, for that matter, is the example for all those today in our churches that are younger, that are 13, that are 18, that are 20, that are 30? And I want to suggest to you this morning, and back it up with some proof and evidence, but I want to suggest to you who the perfect example is for each of your lives. And that is looking at Jesus Christ. We could get into the Bible. We could talk about David killing Goliath and slaying and doing all the things that David did. Or we could talk about Daniel purposing in his heart not to eat the king's meat or to drink his wine. We could talk about Jeremiah as the young prophet who was scared to death to step out. But the Lord pushed him and he went for it. But rather, I'd rather talk about the ultimate example for us. The ultimate example. As good as Daniel is, as good as David is, as good as Jeremiah might be, They cannot hold a candle to our hero, to our Savior, to Jesus Christ. Now, having said that, there's one and only one place. You say, well, Joe, explain this to us. You know, show me where, how exactly this works. You know, we don't think of the Lord oftentimes because it was just so huge what was going on and what he was doing. But what about the earlier years? There's one and only one place in the Bible that shows us Jesus as a young man. We don't really know much about his youth except in that one place. But in that one story, we have, I believe, guys, I believe that we see all six of these characteristics modeled for us perfectly in the life of Jesus Christ. And so, what I want you guys to do is I want you to keep your finger right there in 1 Timothy, and I want you to turn over to Luke chapter 2. Luke's gospel. And any of you guys that are desiring, and I hope and I pray that all of you desire to be used. And especially those of you that are young, or those of you that are wanting your grandchildren or your younger children to be used of the Lord. This is very important stuff. Now, most of you guys are familiar with this story. And he begins there, I want, in chapter 2 of Luke in verse 45. So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. Well, back up a second and go to verse 41 too. Here it is in verse 41. His parents go to Jerusalem every year for the Feast of Passover. And when he was 12 years old, he went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feasts. So they're celebrating the feast, a convocation that was taking place there in Jerusalem. And then verse 43 says, when they finished the days as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it. And so what is the Lord doing? What is Jesus doing? He's hanging out and around at the church. He stays behind in the holy city, and it says that Joseph and his mother didn't know about it. Notice he didn't say his father and his mother, because Joseph is what? Joseph is the stepfather, not his father. And so Joseph and his mother, they didn't know about it. They didn't know. They traveled in caravans. They had kids running all over the place. And you know how it is. I can't tell you how many times. I won't tell you names. I won't give you names. But I can't tell you how many times we've had kids left here. You know, after Sunday morning service, after a Wednesday night service. And they're just playing. They're screaming all over the place. And things kind of settle down. And you look at them and you go, hey, Johnny, where's your mom and dad? I don't know. Well, are you going home with somebody else tonight? I don't know. Well, you know, it's like, and then it's so funny when they come back to pick him up. Oh, we forgot him. Oh, man. But notice, they forgot Jesus. And it says in verse 44, why? He says, supposing him to have been in the company, they thought he was there. They thought he was just hanging out. And so they went a day's journey, maybe spending the night at Bobby's or whatever, you know. He goes a day's journey, and they sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. So again, traveling in this family group, if you would, thinking that he was out playing, they didn't find him as they went to look for him. And here it is. You know, they left church and they forgot Jesus. Which brings up another possibility. Is it possible that you leave church and forget Jesus? Something to think about and meditate on. You know, wasn't that great? The music and the worship and just worshiping the Lord, and then you go your way and you forget the Lord. You just leave him behind. It is possible. It is possible. Well, they left Jesus, so to speak, in the sanctuary. It's possible. Ought not to be, but it is. I know he'll never leave us. He'll never forsake us. But we can leave our awareness of him behind. And you see, that's kind of what happened here. They left Jesus and they didn't know as they left church until a day or two later. And actually a day later, but it took them that longer time to get all the way back. Kind of hits you. I mean, we're not just talking a couple hours. You know, it's a long time. Notice verse 46. How long? It was after 3 days. Interesting number of days for you Bible students, by the way. But they found him. They went back and they found him 3 days later. Where did they find him? It says they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. They're in a panic. They left their son. They're running back there as fast as they can. I'm sure 3 days later they get back and they find him in the temple, sitting in the midst of these doctors, not MDs, but scholars and teachers and theologians. And he was both, it says, hearing them and asking them questions. And all heard, everyone that heard him were astonished, it says, at his answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. Amazed. Verse 48. Mom and Dad. And his mother said to him, "Son, why did you do this to us? Why do you do this to me?" You know, kind of, I mean, she's in a panic. "Why do you do this to us? Your father and I have been seeking you," notice, "anxiously." You ever lost one of your kids? We lost Caleb in Costco one time. And we just panicked. And we were looking all over for him. And we went to the manager. We said, "We've lost our son. We don't know where he's at." Boom, they locked the whole Costco down. They shut it down. They put people on each one of the doors. It was just absolutely amazing what they did, because we thought somebody had taken Caleb. Long story short, some guy comes up to him and says, "Hey, is your kid like about this tall, and does he have really, really curly blonde hair, and does he have," and we're going, He says, "Come here, you got to see this." We walked over, I think it was by the dog food, the big bags of dog food, and he had climbed up inside, and he was laying on one of the bags of dog food, just snoring away, man. But it was panic. It was pandemonium. You know, your father and I sought you anxiously. And the Lord said to them, verse 49, "Why did you seek me? Did you?" This kills me. And this is the guy's 12 years old. "Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" But they did not understand the statement which he spoke to them. He went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and with men. Notice, guys, this little vignette, this one little incident, in it we have a record of Jesus as a young man, a youth, who is first of all being an example of the believer in word or in speech. You say, how? Again, look at verse 46. Jesus was there in the temple. The doctors and the learned men were surrounding him, and we're told that he was hearing them and asking them questions. He's like a teenager, 12, 13. He is listening to them. He's taking it all in, and he's asking questions of them. He wasn't yelling at them. He wasn't preaching at them. He wasn't having a tantrum before them. He was humbly listening and asking questions. And I emphasize that because, young person, do you want to be an example of the believer? Then your speech is to be based upon listening. Listening to those that are older than you. You say, "Well, they don't know as much as I do." Well, do you think that Jesus knew more than these guys in the temple that day? I mean, they were quoting the Bible, but he wrote it. You know, go figure. God in flesh, Jesus Christ, dwelling among them. And what was he doing? He was listening. And he was asking questions. And we can all learn from that. And as the conversation that, you know, as it went on, apparently for some time, days really, they were intrigued by this young man. He wasn't trying to stump the doctors. He wasn't trying to trip up the teacher. But rather, he was honestly trying to engage in meaningful conversation by listening and by asking questions. I believe that George Washington was right when he said, when a younger man and an older man are conversing, the older man must never mention that he's older, but the younger man must never forget it. And so you that are younger than 40, up to 40, here's the deal. Be an example of the believer in speech. How? By listening, by asking questions, and then engaging in meaningful conversation that is rich and meaningful. Because you see, after he listened to them and asked questions of them, they heard what he was saying and they were astonished and amazed at the understanding and the answers that he had. Kind of reminds me of Elmer. You know, everyone was a little bit sick of Elmer. You know, because he was a guy that could go around and he would talk, you know, day after day, after month, after year, after decade. I mean, just, you know, he went around and just talk. But the thing he used to love to talk the most about was that he was a survivor of the 1910 Johnstown flood. And this guy, he survived that flood in 1910, that flood that wiped out about 3,000 people in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. But he just talked and talked and talked about it year after year after year. And finally, after 50 years, sometime in the 70s, they say, Elmer died. And the people of the town just kind of went, whew, kind of relieved a little bit, not harshly, but, you know, all this guy would do is come in like gangbusters and tell his story about the Johnstown flood that he had survived. Well, Elmer goes to heaven and he stands before Peter, and Peter says, Elmer, he says, that's me. I'm the survivor of the 1910 Johnstown flood. Okay, well, listen. Hey, it's a great story. Peter, you got to listen to this. I can't wait to tell it. Peter says, okay, but listen. Elmer says, I can't just tell you, Peter. I got to tell everybody. I want everybody. Everybody needs to hear about my story. They need to hear about how I survived the 1910 Johnstown flood. Peter says, well, okay. And so Elmer says, well, Peter, what can we do? You know, can we call a congregational meeting? You know, can we get everybody together? And, you know, I can tell them the story about how I survived the 1910 Johnstown flood. And Peter says, well, I guess we could. Well, when can I do it? When can I tell everybody my story about how I survived the 1910 Johnstown flood? And Peter says, would today at 3 o'clock be fine? And Elmer said, yeah, that'd be great. But Peter, who's going to be there? I got to know. Who's going to be there? And Peter looked at him and said, well, for one, Noah. In our youth, guys, so often, think about it for a while, it'll come to you. When we're young, we say, here's my story. Listen to me. Here's my side. Here's my point. And all I'm saying is, guys, put a cork in it. God gave you two ears and one mouth for a reason. And that is that we're to listen twice as much as we talk. And so we need to learn how to close it down and to open them up. Listen to what they're saying. Ask questions in humility. Even if you know more than your parents or your pastor, be an example of the believer, even as Jesus was. He heard them. He asked questions of them. And then he responded in the conversation in a way that was not offensive, was not threatening, not intimidating, and it wasn't emotional. And they were amazed. They were blown away. And so he says, first of all, be an example in speech. And Jesus was that. Secondly, an example in conduct or conversation or lifestyle. Notice verse 46. And it came to pass that after 3 days, they found him in the temple. So, well, how does that lifestyle? Well, it's definitely Jesus showing his lifestyle. Let me ask you something, guys. If you were to suddenly be discovered as missing, would your mom and dad say, hey, we got to run back to church right now? Because there's no doubt in our mind that he's at church. If you were discovered, if you guys were young, if you were discovered missing and your parents went looking and searching for you, would they go back and call 911 or would they call 687-9084? Hey, is he down there, you know? I know they must be there. my son, my daughter, my grandchild. They've got to be there because that's where they hang out. The idea is that that's where Jesus hung out. And so that's where they went to look. That's a lifestyle for him. In his spare time, in his free time. Guys, where do you gravitate to? Because where Jesus was in church. And you see, the brothers and the sisters will be ones that study the word. They'll be the ones that are worshiping. They'll be the ones that are fellowshipping. Where do we gravitate to? Where would mom and dad find us if we were missing? And Jesus' lifestyle was centered around the church, the things of the kingdom, if you would. It wasn't a part of what he did. It's not a mandated part of his life. It was his life. That was his life. And I'll tell you, you decide as a 15-year-old today that is going to have priority over the things in your life. Whatever those things may be, whether it's TV or sports or work, you say your priority is church, is the Lord and the things of the Lord, the things that are spiritual. Watch and see then how God will bless. If you seek first the kingdom and all these other things, he says they'll be added unto you. You know, whether it be, you know, advances, if you would, in athletics and grades and fulfillment of life, the Lord will do that, but seek first the kingdom of God. And you see that within the Lord when he realized that, you know, he was gone. They went right back to the church, if you would, because that was his lifestyle. It was in his word, his speech. It was in his conduct. Number three, it was in his love, an example. And Paul says, this is the third area as a young person. Be an example in the word, in conversation, and love. Watch what happens. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou dealt thus with us? Why? What have you done to us? We were worried about you, separated from you, and we were concerned. And Mary says, Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. Your dad and I have been looking for you, son. And Jesus' answer was very gentle. He says there, And he said unto them, How is it that you sought me? It's not that I must be about, did you know that I should be about my father's business? And they understood, it says, not the saying which he spoke unto them. You see, Mary kind of goofed here. Your dad and I have been looking for you. Jesus could have said, he's not my dad. Don't you remember the angel deal, mom? You know, don't you remember that whole thing that was going on? Jesus could have said, that's not my dad. But instead, he simply comes back in a way of love. He speaks to them in love. And he corrects his mother, but he does it so very tenderly. And he says, Mom, how is it that you sought me? Don't you know that I must be about my father's business? What he's doing, guys, basically, is he's speaking the truth, but he's speaking it in love. You say, Joe, how do you know that? Because it says in the next verse that they understood not what he spoke. Jesus, if they didn't understand it, didn't look at him and say, well, let me clarify it for you. Let me make it simple for you. No, he simply spoke the truth, and then he backed off. He didn't try to prove his point or grind it home, if you would. Mom, you say your father and I have been looking for me. Mom, he says so gently, my father, that's whose business that I'm doing right now. In his temple, you see. I mean, it's almost like these aren't the droids you're looking for. You know, it's like, Mom, I'm about my father's business. But she didn't get it. He didn't get it either. But the thing I love, because this is how love operates, love didn't press the point. Jesus didn't press the point. He took a step back and he let it stand. How often are you able to do that? How often are you able to just step back, you're able to disengage and allow it to be what it is without getting into a big fight, without insisting upon your rights or wrongs or whatnot? No, he stepped back and he let it stand. Why? Because we're to speak the truth in love. We're not to compromise on the truth. But Paul would later say, the servant of the Lord must not strive, must not fight, must not argue, and Jesus didn't. He's an example of the believer here in just an incredibly beautiful way. And that is that he didn't push it. He simply corrected her very gently, tactfully. And he says, I am about my Father's business. And he let it stand, even though she didn't understand. So in the word, in speech, in conduct, in lifestyle, in love, and number four, in spirit, or the word here means zeal. What does Jesus say and do? He says, look, did you not know that I must be about my Father's business? How we need young people who are not simply saying, well, I'll try to do the Father's business. I'll try to make it to prayer. I'll try, you know, I'll do the best I can do to try and have devotions. There needs to be in you a zeal. That's what the word spirit says. That's the characteristic that he's talking about, where it's not something what you're going to try to do, but it's something that you decide to do. I must, Jesus said, I must be about my Father's business. When did he say that? He said it, Jesus did, when he was 12 years old. Mom, don't you understand? I must. It wasn't I should be. It wasn't I'm trying to be. It wasn't I'm thinking about it. I'm considering it. I'm contemplating it. Jesus said, I must be about this. And Jesus would later on say as an adult in Luke chapter 4, verse 43, I must go to other cities and preach the gospel of the kingdom. He would also say in John chapter 3, the Son of Man must be lifted up on the cross, as he talked to Nicodemus. And then in John chapter 4, he said, I must go through Samaria. Why? Because there was a woman there that needed to know and to hear about salvation. We desperately need that young man, that young woman, that person that's 40 years or less, even all you that are 40 plus, guys, we need to have some zeal. We need to be those that say, I must, that this isn't an option. This is not, well, I'll see how it goes and, you know, go with the flow like a dead fish going down the stream. No. It's got to be that one that says, I must do this. I must die to self. I must preach the word. I must be about my Father's business. I must. You know why so many marriages are wrecked? Why so many lives are wasted? A huge majority is it because people say, I'll try. I'll try. Talking to a couple a while back, and they sat before me and said, we'll try. And I said, no, you'll do. Don't try it, do it. Don't sit there and say, I'll give it a go. No, right now you decide. That's what he was saying in Isaiah chapter 1. Come, let us reason together. Not let us try to reason together. It was none of that. It just says, come, let us reason together. Because if you're willing, if, then you'll eat of the good of the land. You see, he says here at this point, don't try, you do it. Don't sit there and say, I'll give it a go. No, you decide whether or not you're going to do what God says to do. Forget about the I try stuff. That person that says I try will never be used to the greatest degree that God wants to use a person. But when that same person says, I must do this, I must be about my Father's business, no buts, no ifs, no ands, no unless, no maybe, but rather I must.